Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is author and wine columnist, Letty Teague. We'll talk to Letty about wine, words, and more. We'll taste a French Chardonnay for our weekly wine sip. I wasn't going to tell Letty, but I showed her what we're drinking, so we'll figure that out later. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Letty Teague is an award-winning author and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Her column on wine appears three times a month in the journal.
Three times.
Letty has received three James Beard Awards, including the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. Letty Teague was formerly the wine columnist for Food and Wine magazine and its wine editor for 12 years. Letty also has published three books, Wine and Words, Educating Peter, and she illustrated, she's an artist, Fear of Wine. Letty, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Sam.
I'm glad I finally got you on the show. I've been looking forward to having you on.
Well, I hope I don't disappoint.
You will not. I want you to give our guests a little context. So give us a quick background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you currently are, which is writing a wine column for the Wall Street Journal.
Well, it was a career with a pretty inauspicious beginning.
Okay.
But now, since I ended up at the very top of the heap, I guess we can say it turned out well. I guess it began, and this is kind of irresponsible because I've gotten so very old to begin my story in college, but it actually does in a profound way, because I spent my junior year in Ireland and lived with a family whose father was a wine merchant. And as someone that grew up in the Midwest, mostly, I had a pretty unsophisticated sense of what wine was, and living with a father who would bring wine home every night, and his wife, who was a terrific chef, would pair with it, and they would talk about wine and pairing wine. I ended up working a little bit in the wine shop. I ended up drinking a lot of wine, and I decided, without really understanding what it meant, I wanted a career in the wine business, and thus beget a checkered career in the wine business.
Of a checkered career.
It was. Right. Hopefully, it's less checkered now. But okay. I did a lot of things unsuccessfully in the wine business. I sold wine, and I mined all of my lack of successes for topics for my column. So you know, in the end, they proved worthwhile. But selling wholesale on the streets of New York, working in a restaurant, doing marketing and PR for wine companies, basically everything you could do. A friend of mine called me Letty of a Thousand Jobs because I worked for multiple wine wholesalers. And
so you were that into it that you never got discouraged.
I was that misguided.
Like wholesale sales,
well,
you tried something else.
I was no
else.
Good at it, Sam.
Okay.
But the one thing that stuck was the writing, and and just on a lark, my food and wine career actually began. Well, my very first magazine job was at a magazine that no longer exists called Diversion, and it was a travel and leisure magazine for physicians published by Hearst. And I auditioned for a job that I had no business auditioning for, and that was their food, wine, and books editor. And at a like 75% pay cut, they offered me the job after I did a writing
test. Wait, it was
a
travel magazine?
Travel and Leisure magazine
for doctors.
Physicians, yeah.
So it was sort of a trade magazine to
them.
No,
it wasn't trade. It was like Travel and Leisure, but for doctors. And Hearst
was it,
really
did they put it on the lobby table or it was
yeah,
in their
like
office?
Every doctor got diversion. It was a really nice little magazine run by some very nice people. One of whom has gone on to be the editor of a prominent women's magazine. But at any rate,
Official wine writing job.
First official. So
then.
And then I wrote a freelance story for Food and Wine magazine called Why I Hate to Eat with My Husband. My husband at the time was the very famous Alan Richman, and they loved it. They thought it was really funny, and they told me they're looking for a wine editor. And I said, "What about me?" And and they had no idea that I had this whole checkered career in the world of wine. And
they didn't need to
know. Well, they found out.
So how long after that did they put you on staff?
I guess it was about 3 months after that.
Wow, yeah. That was quick.
Yeah. Well, it seemed forever to me, Sam.
Well, at that time.
Waiting around.
Now you look back. So that was, tell me about Food and Wine. That was the beginning of a pretty long tenure.
Yeah, that was in 1997, which was the real heyday. Well, the heyday for so many things. Heyday for magazine world, heyday for the wine world. I was Robert Parker and Stephen Tanzer's editor.
Two separate ventures, though, right?
Well, they each wrote alternating columns. Tanzer didn't last so very long, but Bob and I became quite friendly, and he remained a columnist for some time. And then, you know,
was he doing his own?
He was doing his newsletter. Yeah, at the time.
He was doing both.
No.
Okay,
but he was a contributing.
And was Tanzer doing his newsletter?
He was doing his newsletter too.
Okay,
but ultimately he just
did. They
his
get
newsletter.
The job at the magazine because of their newsletters?
I would expect so, but
probably,
I couldn't
right.
say since it predated me.
Right. You know. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So you wrote with. For Parker and Tanzer?
No, I was their editor.
You were their editor.
I was their editor. And
okay.
many, and the editor of many other wine writers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so you're at Food and Wine for about a dozen years.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens?
Oh, and then I ended up getting downsized in the great magazine Downsize, which was also the great, you know, downsize of the American economy in 2009. And I ended up just writing the column. I was a columnist. So, and then late in 2009, I got the word, someone that I just happened to meet, that the journal was looking for a wine columnist, and would I be interested?
And nope.
And you can imagine what I said.
No hesitations, right?
By golly, yes. Yeah.
I know who you were writing with, but when you got there, who was doing the column?
Well, as you may remember,
there was a
Dorothy
couple.
Gator and her husband were you know
for many years, right.
I think for 12 years. Actually.
Right, you came
John,
in
John Brescher and Dorothy Gator, who I'd never met. I'd never met.
Right,
you
know. Right. Like you said, they were there for a lot of years.
Right.
And you are currently at the Wall Street Journal. It's funny that you mentioned downsizing then. There seems to be a lot of downsizing now.
Well, it's just continuous.
In
magazines
the food
and newspapers.
Food and wine
and,
category specifically.
Yeah.
And magazines
it.
Per
yeah,
se
it's
and
very
everything.
Sad. It's very sad.
All right, let's talk about Letty and writing and all of that. I told you earlier I'm as interested in the process of writing as much as writing about wine.
I don't know if that's interesting, Sam.
Well,
the
I'll make it interesting.
The process of writing. The process of writing is not writing.
but you know what I mean. So I have a bunch of curiosities. Any big difference between writing for a weekly newspaper column versus a magazine?
Oh, profound difference. Profound. And I'll tell you the
I think
way
some people could spot them, but
it.
Tell
well,
me.
The biggest one, well, two very big ones, which were, you know, which I only realized when I began. First of all, especially a newspaper like the Wall Street Journal, where readers are very, obviously they're very intelligent, but they're also very engaged, and they will tell you what they think of your column, and of course in a magazine, and back in the day, nobody could leave comments anyway, and nobody really leaves comments on the monthly, you know, it's just not a thing. But on newspaper, as I'm sure you've seen, on newspaper
so demographics
websites,
and
you know,
sort of the immediacy every day,
you know,
right?
It would tell me exactly what they thought of me or the column or of the idea, and also in a good way too. I mean, you're getting instant, you know, feedback, but it's also a very, very important fact of writing for the journal, and I can't speak to other newspapers, but we practice no surprises journalism, and that means that if I'm writing something critical of someone, that I tell them, you know, I'm writing this about you.
In advance of the column coming out.
Yeah, to give them a chance to respond, and that's just, you know, principle, I think, of good journalism.
How did that work out? I mean,
it doesn't always make you friends.
Well, no, I know that, but looking back, is that the right thing to do?
Oh, I think so. Yeah,
I do
you rather
too.
Know?
But
I think that,
and like you said, it's not going to always work.
Well, I mean, it's not going to make people happy, but I think people always want to know. I think you always want to know something rather than to wake up the next morning and find something, you know, in the newspaper the next day. And again, that's just not my column. That's the practice of, you know, of journalist, of good journalist, you know. Period.
Was it your style, where most of the time you were notifying people where it seemed negative? Or
I think you can, if you read my, you know, umpteen columns that I've written in the past 8 years,
I
you'd say that there's
so.
Pretty limited number of times that I've had to make an unfortunate call. Although one I remember quite distinctly because it was about extortionate restaurant wine list pricing. And there's
that's a subject that needed to be discussed anyway.
Yeah, it did. And,
you know, that's fair.
And I did tell this particular very successful New York City restaurateur that I'm going to be writing about the fact that he had priced his wines at 5 times wholesale, and you know, and I thought it was a pretty egregious thing. Did he have a response? And he wrote me. I think it was if you had printed the email, it was probably would have been 3 pages long.
Wow.
So you know what? I've got to edit that to a couple lines.
Jesus.
So yeah,
that's fair though. It's fair to tell him, and
right.
I'm sure he couldn't defend it, but whatever.
Right. He didn't lower his prices.
No, you didn't influence that, but you brought attention to it. What about content? I mean, is it obvious that a magazine piece is more words and more in depth than a weekly column, or
that
not
is a
necessarily?
Great advantage, sure. I mean, I miss my column in
that's
the
pretty
magazine
much the...
for that, because I had sometimes close to 3,000 words, which as a writer, it just gives you room to stretch and tell wonderful, funny, interesting, idiosyncratic stories. And when I have 1,200 words in the journal.
It's almost a third.
Yeah, it's a bit of a haiku, you know,
right.
So it's great.
Did you have to discipline yourself, or you just turn a different switch on?
Well, fortunately, it happened gradually. My column originally was 1,800 words, right. So I had a little bit more, and then they sort of put me on a diet slowly.
All right, my last curiosity.
The last one, Sam. We
well, no,
have
I have a million other questions. But there was a time, and I just want you to respond to this quickly. There was a time, including you, where the Journal had 3 wine columnists.
They did. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting across now from the one.
That's right.
What was that about?
The woman.
I mean, Food and Wine, Bon Appetit, they didn't have 3 wine columnists.
I know they didn't. Well, but the Journal is, first of all, one of the wine columnists was based in the UK, Will Lyons.
Okay.
And he was only in the European edition of WSJ, although you would see his column online. And that just, and again, I'm not privy to the decisions made by the editorial powers that be, and Jay was
McInerney.
Jay McInerney was he was not on staff. I've always been on staff at the Journal, and he was a contract, and I think that he was there for 4 years. I think for the Journal.
What's the thinking? It was like a prestige thing, you know. Here's a prolific writer.
Yeah, I
also wrote
again,
wine books.
I don't know. Maybe they thought we have a guy and a girl, and
maybe.
Then we have an Englishman.
It could be that simple.
I have no idea.
And you've been writing the column solo for how long?
For 4 years.
For 4 years is when Jay left. Mm-hmm. All right. So how do you?
I mean, for 8 years altogether.
Right.
4 years solo.
Before right. Three times a month. How do you select subject matter? I mean, are you inspired, or the things
always,
you have
yeah,
to?
Yeah.
Do you ever get stuck, writer's block?
Never.
I mean, how do you...
You know, I have to say...
Tell me about the genesis of, you know, how columns come together.
I tried to have different types of columns, service columns. So, you know...
Thematically.
Because people always want to be, you know, good wines to buy. Like when I wrote about my love of Chablis and you know, great Chablis to buy. idea columns. So like looking at the extortionate wine list pricing, sometimes destination stories. Like I did a column not so long ago about Charleston, which I just happened to.
I was just down at the wine festival.
You know, the wine scene is exploding down there.
And I was there the opening night of Graft, which you'd written about.
Yeah.
And Vintage and Monarch.
Right.
We were all,
so,
it's a terrific
such
scene.
A dynamic wine scene. You know,
I think it was a very timely article as far as everything that's going
right,
on
and
there.
And it just, I'd been there a year ago because I have a good friend that has a place there.
Right.
And even a year ago, it wasn't the scene that it is now.
Right.
You know, today, and then sometimes I do fun stories as well. You know that maybe are a little more. I did a story that this was as I was joking to you earlier. If Costco is in the column, then we know that lots of people are going to care. But when I first moved to New Jersey, one of the things that I was told I had to do was to join Costco. My husband actually told me that. He said you need a Costco card, and I thought this is kind of ridiculous. It took me to all these years to join Costco, but it was sort of I knew certainly from the world of wine how many good wines show up at Costco, but going there and then finding these wines and writing about these wines, but then also interviewing winemakers like Doug Schaefer. I said, how did Schaefer Merlot end up at Costco? And he would say, well, I don't know. And then I would ask somebody else, and to a man, the producers all said, I have no idea how my wine ended up at Costco.
Doug Schaefer's an ornery guy. Did he say, I don't know? Did he say I don't know because he didn't want to fess up to that he's at Costco, or he really didn't know?
I think it was clear, like every producer that, and I don't mean to single out just Doug, but so many producers. When I said, "How did you know your wine was there?"
Right.
They affected great surprise. It was like in Casablanca, there's gambling going on here. Gambling?
Yeah, but that caught the reader's attention,
right? And then some of them lambasted me for being so late in discovering Costco in the first place.
Well, that's okay.
I lived in New York City for a long time.
So those are themes. You want something to be fun or whatever. Do you ever realize I just wrote three fun columns in a row? Does that happen?
No, because we always try to mix it up.
I have a
really good editor, and we Beth Cracklauer, and we talk about. And she's great. The one thing that I feel like, if you could say that, and not to give myself a pat on the back, but I have a lot of ideas. I never run out of ideas.
Well, I was going to ask you, are you working on multiple stories at once? There's two, three.
Things are always, I have this really fun idea that we're going to, because we want to have like a fun column soon. So she and I are excited about. And,
if the idea pops in, you'll develop it so that
and
you don't lose.
And it's fast. You know, that's the great thing is you can say, this is my idea. And because I have a weekly column, it can become real very quickly.
Do you have more topics floating around your head than you have space to write them in, or you could spread it out pretty evenly?
I think I do. I think, because as a columnist, you can't ever be without ideas, and that so far, so good.
That I know, but you're not backed up or so anxious to.
Well, because you want to be timely, too. You know,
right.
After all,
so
it's a
newspaper. Forces
so you have
to,
have to allow for the possibility that, something may supplant another idea if it's a little more timely. Yeah.
So how long does it take to write a column? I mean, we just talked about how you're working on multiple ideas and it could involve travel or whatever.
Well, writing is not writing. You know, as every writer I'm sure you've ever interviewed would say, you spend a lot of time not writing.
Right.
And then here's a very funny thing.
It's like 20 hours of misery in an hour of like 40 pages.
Right, like, okay, good. Yeah. Well, I never get that many. But there was this writing coach. His name, what was his name? He was a writing coach from an Oregon newspaper. And this was years ago when I was my first presentation at the Napa Valley Writers Conference, and he was talking about effective rewriting, and he said there are three kinds of effective rewriting, and I don't remember what the other two were, but the one that was not effective was to you write a little bit and then go back and polish it and then write a little bit more, then go back and polish it and write a little more, then write and he was like, I said, that's what I do. That's what I do. That's what it takes. And I was telling my friend Ben Cheever, he said, well, that's what I do. And then every writer I spoke to said, well, that's what I do. I thought, okay, well, then at least we're all writing ineffectively by going back and
I guess that's sort of the formula. Does that play differently if you're writing a book versus a column? Because
a book you
got
to
lay
going.
Out. It's the same principle in smaller doses and all of that.
Right.
I'm curious again. Do you have
to
travel?
It's a good quality in a radio interview.
Do you have to travel much? Do you travel much? Are you tasting a lot? Because I remember last year I bumped into you at a New York State wine tasting. I recognize you. I think I handed you my card, and then I stalked you for about a half a year.
Are you
traveling a lot and drinking a lot, or you can keep that under control?
Not a lot. Not a lot of either, actually. And it's not always, you know, it's not drinking, but tasting, of course. So,
like, Feb and March are huge tasting months in New York.
Yeah, there are a lot of producers coming to town.
Do you do a lot of that? I don't do a lot.
I do some, and when I can. Sometimes it just depends on, I think, you know, A, if I'm in town, or B, if I have a column due or what have you. But
right.
It's also really, I mean, I buy all the wines for my column. I don't take anything for free.
Right.
No, I send back, you know, any samples I get. But trade tastings are challenging just because sometimes the really good ones are super, super crowded, you know.
Yeah.
But it's nice to be able to see maybe some producers that are in town for those.
Yeah. So you don't feel compelled to have to taste all the time and taste everything. And
it would be nice, but
it would. But you go where you have to when you have to.
Exactly.
Right? You know,
exactly.
If you're doing a story on Chablis,
right? That's all I'm doing.
You know, you'll spend the time on
Chablis, which always makes me happy.
It's still pretty early in the year, and I wanted to get your take on. I mean, who better than you to at least approach answering this? What big stories, events, or trends in 2017 from your writing, from stories, from things that, you know, can you pinpoint a couple of things?
I think one big story.
Just 2017, not now or wine,
right.
Where things are going.
You mean from the vintage 2017?
No, from the world of wine,
okay.
Which could be a vintage, it could be an event. I mean, the Napa Fires was certainly an event.
Right,
but,
right.
But, you know, in your mind.
I think in this country, a huge issue is going to be labor. You've seen it. It's affecting farms, and certainly it's going to affect wineries. You know, the labor now to do the work in the vineyard and then to harvest in the fall, and that there have been, you know, a lot of farm labor, you know, has been scared off. That's tied to the current immigration situation. Absolutely, I think that's
However, it was a more trying situation now.
I think that
I don't disagree. We'll see the repercussions,
you know, certainly come harvest. And I know that producers, I was in California a couple weeks ago, that's one of the number one concerns, you know, will they have the labor?
I think that's unique to the U.S. Yeah. I'm sure in Europe, you know, it's the same.
Right, right, right. And that's what I said in America.
That's a good point, and I think it's a timely point. Anything else? Anything else tickle your fancy?
Well, I mean, in South Africa, you have the situation with the drought, you know, and how that's going to, you know, affect the producers there. I think, you know, in Italy, I'm not aware of this. In South Africa right now, they're talking about the wine growing area. Well, in Cape Town area, and I know that there. I mean, from what I understand, the concern is not yet grave, but, you know, we've seen that in other parts of the world, in Spain in the past. And then, I don't know, just a certain amount of maybe political instability of a concern. I mean, look what's happening in Italy, you know. I think just an unstable world is never good for the wine world either.
I think you're starting to see the beginning of instability.
But I'm just a wine columnist, so, you know, there are people that are far better equipped to...
And I just host a wine show, so you and I
so we're going to check our
our political stuff at the coat check thing. I mentioned this to you earlier, and I want to get your take on it, because it's an important thing in wine, and certainly if you're in Brooklyn, there's a very big natural wine scene. Under that umbrella is organic, biodynamic,
right?
All of that stuff. I don't want to get into
the politics.
Not the but the, you know, what's the difference between biodynamic and natural and all that? But the movement, there's just, I think the natural wine scene is here, and it's a broad question, but, you know, give me your take on it generally, and then we'll try to focus in.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly all for you know, wine to be made as naturally as possible, and for, you know, for producers to eschew pesticides where they can, and any kind of, you know, topical treatments, any kind of use of chemicals, any kind of manipulation. But at the same time, I don't. Well, two things. One is I don't like wine that is flawed. So wine that hasn't actually, you know, maybe an application of sulfites would have stabilized the wine. And so it would not have, you know, turned brown, and it would have, you know, not been oxidative.
And
or,
more of that exists
or Brett and
in the real natural wine
right.
Because there are a lot of famous wines and winemakers that have been practicing sustainable natural right. that don't
but are also
toot
interested
horn.
In just making wine that tastes good. Yeah. It isn't flawed.
And know? Then there's and the natural you know.
Well, and that's the second point I was going to say is the ideology. I eschew ideology in all forms, and certainly in the world of wine, because I don't think that ideology it's like being a journalist. I shouldn't have an ideology, and nor should any good journalist, and nor should any winemaker. The only goal is to write well and honestly and truthfully and accurately, and I think the same is true of winemaking. You just make a wine that is, you know, that is well made and will last for a certain amount of time on a retail store shelf or in a restaurant cellar. And to have this kind of, you know, it is anti, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us kind of mentality is not something that I have any interest in participating in.
Is this something that is going to continue and heat up even more, or at some point, everybody's just going to.
I think it's because you know maybe if you you know with history as a guide, there have been so many different movements you know in the world of wine, and I think that the people, the natural winemakers, the so-called you know the ones that are making good wine will continue to make good wine, and that probably that label will become less important. But you know, I mean, wine is subject like anything is subject to fads, you know, and people that. You know, it's funny because we were speaking of Charleston and Charleston, which is this very new, you know, a nascent wine market in terms of sophistication and a range of wines that are now available there. And I was joking with this guy, the owner of a wine bar. I said, you know, why is it you've got so much natural wine here in a place that like last year had California Chardonnay and Cabernet. It's like everybody like just said, okay, that's it. We're all going to, this means we're sophisticated now. We'll have like 10 Pet Nats and we'll have, you know, right. wines from the Jura and we'll have, you know, it's like, no, there's room for traditional wines too. You've kind of skipped a big step, you know, yeah, of understanding classic wines. You know?
I think that's a good point. And I think to your point earlier, I mean, the end product, the consistency is important. I mean, if there's a natural wine where it's inconsistent, it's crappy, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that guy's going to...
Well, no one's going to
just
because
he's natural. Yeah. I mean, I think people are going to, you know, identify all of that. Do you think this generation of sommeliers, you know, restaurants used to be palaces, chefs became rock stars, now sommeliers are sharing the light. Do you think somms or some of them and distributors, importers are kind of pushing the natural thing too?
Not really.
Not major.
Really.
In a major
I think
way.
You know, and I think like anything, those psalms that have that you know. I think if you think back when you're in your 20s, you're like everything matters
Too
so
long.
Much. You know, everyone's so passionate about things, and sommeliers by definition are young.
So you know, it's a good point.
You know, so
talk to me in 15 years.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, and we'll see how many of them are.
Yeah,
are
that's a good point.
Crazed.
Yeah. You know, I read somewhere you sort of chided low alcohol wines, which is a psalm. Favorite.
I mean, praised high alcohol. Actually, it was worse. I praised high
right.
alcohol wine.
Every som that comes in here, their favorite wine is Riesling, which tends to be a low alcohol wine.
Right.
Is that
not Vino Verde? Why don't they love Vino Verde?
Right.
It's even lower in alcohol.
No, because Riesling is cooler.
Right. Let's have a movement.
I mean, why do you feel that way?
Why do I feel
like low alcohol wines?
I don't know to have anything against low alcohol
okay.
wines. I just
you just chided
like
them thing, a little.
I don't like anything just for the sake of it. You know, for any one thing. You know, if it's low alcohol but is delicious and has flavor, yes. But if it's low alcohol for the sake of low alcohol,
right.
I'm not jumping on that.
I get
anyway.
That. We're talking to Letty Teague. Letty Teague is the wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal. You could read her column 3 times every month. I wanted to ask you one last thing before we break, and then when we come back, talk about your books a little, and I want to subject you to our wine test. Subject you. I'm going to tape you to the chair. Since you've been writing, even just at the Journal, has social media and have millennials had a major effect on wine, how we view it, buy it, patterns and all of that? I mean, is it big enough to talk about?
Oh, I think, and I wrote a column, actually one of the, you know, a very popular column because the topic is very popular about millennials drinking wine, and they are, you know, said to be the largest generation of, in however many recent generations, and their wine consumption, and so their wine consumption matters. And the standard line is that millennials care, they don't care about points, they care about stories, and I think that's, That's probably true. I mean, this is all wildly anecdotal and so completely not scientific, but it is
reported that
you know, I think because they millennials that are often being led by millennial sommeliers who are telling them the stories, so they're responding to those stories, and as one who is a writer, I'm all for that, because I think if you're looking for some, and not just a soundbite, but if they're truly looking for some kind of in-depth narrative or even slightly superficial narrative of this producer or of this grape, you know, it's something that they can feel, you know, more sort of, you know, compelled by it and feel more personally.
Right.
As opposed, but what makes me a bit itchy is when the corollary, truth, quote unquote, is that middle-aged people only care about points. You know, like young people care about stories, and middle-aged people. It's like, no, actually, we care about those stories too. I mean, certainly as a journalist, I know, but I think people
millennials
who love wine do.
Are into stories and experiences, and they're.
But I am too. Are you?
Me too. But I also think, you know, our friends, our age, and all of that. I would rather try five wines that Letty Teague wrote a column about, like, say, Chablis, where it was
well. You're the perfect man,
well,
Sam.
Well, I am the perfect man, but where it's well researched and there are recommendations, you know, I'd be very curious about that versus somebody who handed me a list of here's five wines that are 90 plus,
right,
which is a
by somebody
90 plus.
They have to be at least 95 for you to care, right?
You know, so to me, I think people are, you know, moving away from that. That's sort of been a big topic
but
here.
But do you remember, and this is like going back a million years, there was a restaurant in Soho that actually had, they published the points
on the wine list.
And it was the back in the day, it was only the Wine Spectator and maybe the Wine Enthusiast, but that it used to crack me up that they would have like 87 point wines on the list.
Yeah, I still.
Which you can never get away with now.
But you go into a wine store and you'll see that.
Right, everything has
95 points. I mean, if it's $8.99, 87 isn't bad.
No, Sam, no one's ever going to be. That's actually, I wrote a column on where I drank only 88 point wines, because I thought, you know, it's kind of like 88 point wines, it's respectable, but it's not, you know, they're not going to be expensive, and they're not going
so
to be.
So one theme was the price was reasonable, right? Value.
But one, it was just like, I was in search of the grade B wines, you know, like perfectly nice wines, like a nice enough wine to have on a Tuesday night.
Are these the sort of manufactured wines that people talked about?
No, 88 point wines are like a nice Muscadet, you know. Right. It's not something they'll blow your socks off, but, you know, you'll be perfectly
pleased. A very, very serviceable wine.
Right, it's like coming home with a B on your report card.
Right.
Once upon a time, that was acceptable.
Do millennials, to that point, do they want to spend money on wine, or they're more?
I think if they have money, sure.
Right, but trophies and price and everything is not so much an issue.
I wouldn't. You know what? Since I'm a journalist, I eschew, you know, careless generalizations.
Yeah,
I think that's, you know.
You're right about that. All right, Letty, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Letty Teague. Letty Teague is the wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal. When we come back, Letty wrote a few interesting books we'll talk about for a few minutes, and then I will subject her to our wine list. And then Letty and I are going to taste a French Chardonnay that we have some differences about,
maybe.
For our weekly wine sip. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sertori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Letty Teague. Letty is the wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Letty also wrote a bunch of books, which I want to talk to you about quickly. We'll start from the oldest to the newest. We talked about how you got your chops in writing, Food and Wine, Wall Street Journal, edited. I mean, pretty impressive and prolific. But your first book, you were an illustrator.
A cartoonist.
Cartoonist. Are you a closet cartoonist? I mean, how did this come about? It was a wine book.
Yeah. But Fear you of were Wine. With the best title.
The book was called, what was the title?
Fear of Wine.
Fear of
Wasn't
Wine.
That a brilliant title. I can say that because it wasn't my idea.
That is a good title.
I aspired to be a cartoonist. I even created cartoon panels and sent them off, which now is such an antiquated notion since there are no cartoons
right.
in
well,
newspapers
New Yorker
anymore.
Every now
right.
and then.
Right. Oh, actually, I went to college with a girl whose father, Lee Lorenz, was the cartoon editor of the New Yorker. What a sweet man that he was.
Powerful dude, though.
Powerful. What, yeah. And I wrote him when I graduated school, and I said, I want to be a cartoonist. And he basically was like, good luck. Because if there's one job that could make being a wine columnist look like a cinch, it would be being a cartoonist, which is almost impossible. But when I came out with Fear of Wine, I sent him a copy. And he remembered. He said, congratulations, you actually did it. It was a miracle. And in fact, that book, which was published in 1995, is still in print. You can probably buy it for a dollar on Amazon, but
that's okay.
It's
worth more, yeah. but
maybe two.
Did like little Letty in like seventh grade? Were you like doodling?
I was always cartooning. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You kind of formed everything through the years. So
when I was working at Morell and Company, which was my first job ever, in the retail
Morell the wine
Morell,
store.
Yeah, Morell. Okay. Morell wine used to be called Morell and Company.
Right.
But I was like cartooning on sales slips everywhere.
Oh, you
like,
are.
Filled with cartoons. Yeah.
That's funny. So Letty started as an illustrator, but she stayed in wine. Her next book, I love the premise, and it's called Educating Peter. And I think you need to tell us two things, who Peter is, mm-hmm. and Educating Peter kind of explains it, but you know... Well, open that up for me a little.
The Peter of the title is Peter Travers, the witty and wildly popular film critic for Rolling Stone. And Peter Travers was once upon a time my neighbor in suburban New York. And when I met Peter, who once worked at People magazine with my ex-husband, Alan Richman, we discovered that Peter had a fear of any wine. He had the only wine that he liked was something he called Fatty Chardonnay.
And
that was,
which is like
which
the
is
big
oaky,
buttery
yeah,
oaky.
But he loved that he called it fatty. And,
it's a good description.
And, the only wine that he was terrified of Riesling. And he was...
Too thin, too sweet.
He just was terrified. I think the bottle, the shape of the bottle, the acidity, the sweet, what you name it. But so I thought, if I could take a guy like Peter, who was obviously a very witty, very clever guy, but very opinionated and deeply ignorant man, and educate him to the ways of wine, then and he would sort of be the foil for and for every question that someone wanting to know about wine, but questions they are perhaps afraid to ask, like why do they call the scent of a Sauvignon Blanc cat's pee, and why is that even acceptable in polite company? So Our question, our back and forth was a three-part series in Food and Wine, and that's what led to the book, and it led to, you know, Peter and I spending an inordinate amount of time together tasting and spitting.
I was going to ask you.
Talking about
what are
films.
We talking about, no. A year?
It was
year
about a year.
Half?
It was about a year. And then Peter was name-dropping throughout. He would say, like, oh, well, Marty doesn't like Chianti, and that was Marty Scorsese. And then as his reward, I took him to the Napa Valley, and he was obsessed with Ed Sobraja, who was then the head winemaker of Behringer. And because Ed made
bigger than life, right?
Now he's not anymore, but no. He also made bigger than life Chardonnays, right. Which are like Peter's, you know, absolute pinnacle of what a great wine should be, and the private reserve Chardonnay. And so when he met Ed Sobraja, it was like meeting, you know, a Hollywood film star.
Yeah. Well, that's educating Peter. That was a very, very cool premise. Executed well, like, and Peter was the perfect.
Yeah, Peter was great.
You know, yeah. Now that everyone knows who Peter is, it's still a good book to go out and buy. Thank you for that, Sam. It's timely. All right, and your most recent book, which is not that old. I mean, a couple of years, 3 years old or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wine in Words. It's a series of essays on stuff you really need to know about wine. You know,
fun little essays. And a beautiful design by Rizzoli. Rizzoli just has gorgeous
Very
books.
Cool book company. I asked you off air, and I want you to answer on air. There seems to be a proliferation of how-to books.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple things. A bunch of them have come out in the last few years.
They're always coming out.
Yeah, but there seems to be a bunch. You got to jump on them. But what compelled you to write it, and why is your how-to a little different?
Okay. Well, you mean the book that's coming on? Well, I'm not going to.
No, not new.
Not the one that I'm working on. Okay.
The current one.
Well,
which is still a great book to buy.
Yeah, Wine in Words. You know what? I want to just brief little essays, hopefully fun but opinionated. You know, takes on, you know, things like questions that people might ask, like, you know, why is the appropriate cellar temperature 55 degrees? Or, you know, what exactly is a wine collector? Or why Chablis is the greatest white wine in the world? And just funny,
practical,
you know,
stuff.
Practical stuff.
No
fun
maps.
Stuff.
No maps, pictures of rocks. Yeah. None of that.
Or why winery dogs are such a big thing. I was like, why?
Why does every winery have a dog in their picture?
And why are there? Are there like five books about winery dogs? Anyway, things like that.
So that's a very fun, interesting, a little irreverent take.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, Letty knows her wine. If you want to delve into wine a little deeper, but have a little fun, Wine and Words still make sense.
I thank you for saying so. Let's hope so.
So. Wine and Words is probably available at booksellers, Amazon. I bet you could find Educating Peter. You're right about the illustrated book. Maybe you can get that for a buck somewhere.
Yes.
But still, whatever.
Invest 95 cents.
Yeah. All right, Letty. We're going to move on. As I said, I'm going to subject you to our weekly wine list. We ask our guests every week pretty much the same questions, and everyone has a different take, and I want to get your take on what you're doing with wine right now. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Not right now, but are you tasting through a certain type of wine? Is it seasonal? Drinking a lot for a column? What's on the table now?
Okay. Well, I just finished a column I reported in California with actually behind the scenes sort of look at vineyard managers, and that's coming out in the journal tomorrow online, which is a whole different side, and that's not what one is tasting.
Is this going to be a column?
Yeah, this is a column.
So this is really for wine, the guys that are really behind.
Yeah, these are guys that nobody really thinks about, but they're the real talent.
If you talk to Steve Mathiasen, and it's about farming, and these are the guys.
These are the guys. These are the guys that's all they ever do. And then another column I have coming up, it's the 10 wines, and I'm not going to say what they are, but it's for our spring. We do a spring 50, just like we do a fall 50, and it's the wines that fit with the theme, but I'm not at liberty to say what the theme is.
So I'm not going to twist your arm, but to work around that, give me some specific things you're drinking.
I'm finding more right now than
a month ago.
I find myself drinking a lot of, first of all, a surprisingly large amount of white wine, even though it's, you know, we're in New York and it's
winter.
Snowy. I know.
Right.
I drink a lot of Chablis. I drink a lot of Chenin Blanc. I've been drinking some Muscadet just because I've been
some cool white wines.
Yeah, some cool whites, but also red wines from Etna in Sicily.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and so that's been, because I think that's, you know, really.
What are the predominant grapes? Is that
Nerella Mascalese,
right?
Which is, you know, sort of many have called like the Pinot Noir of Sicily because it has that same kind of transparency. I think, right. you know, in some cases it has a little more tannin than that. But so Sicilian reds then sort of, you know, because I think there's also great price quality yeah, ratio.
There's great value there for the quality.
And you know, and basic red Bourgogne. So, you know, because I'm a journalist and that's right. all I could afford.
Right.
And also just, you know, some...
What about Gamay?
And Gamay,
Beaujolais,
for sure. Beaujolais, a lot of Cru
stuff.
Beaujolais.
It's delicious right now. The last
absolutely.
Three vintages.
Absolutely. Gruner Veltliner is in the lineup.
All right,
too.
So you covered yeah. enough. Yeah. Those are all great okay. wines. All right, so take that a step further, and what is Letty Teague's favorite wine and food pairing? Something that you're not doing every night, but you oh wow it when it's in front of you.
Well, you know what I really want to eat more of, and I'm a bit stymied because my husband is very anti, is crab cakes. Thanks to my ex-husband, Alan Richman, who the very first trip we went on was a search for the perfect Maryland crab cake. So thanks to Alan, I have the perfect recipe of the Maryland crab cake, and I only get to, we have an agreement that I can make it once a month, but no more. But so I get
you
to make
eat it more, first of all.
I really more. Tomorrow is the is my day.
And that's the food
cake.
You're ready to pair with it. What?
Oh, Chablis.
Chablis?
Yeah, and I think I've got Patrick Puiz, you know.
P-I-U-Z-E?
P-I-U-Z-E, yes.
Right.
Yeah. He's a Canadian who went
right.
to Chablis. Yeah.
Good story.
Yeah.
So yeah. he makes a good value-oriented
Chablis.
Oh,
yeah,
Chablis.
He makes a bunch of different
Give
Chablis.
Give me yeah. another...
Terroir de Chablis is one of his basic ones, Valet de Savallon.
I'll put those in our social media. Give me one more Chablis.
Again, things that people can find readily,
yeah.
like the Drouin Chablis
right.
is very findable. The 2015
big wine
is
house.
Dynamite. It's $20. Yeah.
So 15 is a vintage. Is a vintage to buy and drink now. Hold
yeah,
a little.
15 is a drink. Now it was a warm vintage. Like the wines are very expressive. 14 is probably the more classic vintage.
Right.
If you find
that's what
14.
Everyone's saying. Yeah. So the pairing is a crab cake with a delicious Chablis.
Yes, please.
Okay, I like that. Can you tell me, and I guess we could stay in New York because that's where you spend all your time, your favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And the answer is a place that has a sensitivity and a knowledge towards wine service selection.
Well, I'm not going to say favorite because there are a lot of, there's
and,
so
and
many
I realize
smart people.
It's incriminating sometimes.
Give I'll tell
me
you where
Letty
I'm going
Teague's
next.
Good ones.
How about if I just tell you where I'm going next? Because
I know
haven't
the
been
answer.
There. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Because he's been a guest on your show.
But that's a legit answer
now.
Anyway.
Well, it is. I haven't been to Le Bernardin in a while, and that's where I'm going next week. And to be in the hands of Aldo Somm is just one of life's great blessings, because Aldo is, as everyone knows, brilliant and fun.
And Eric repairs food.
It's yeah, just, and Eric repairs
food. It's so, truly so, yeah. a great experience. Right. Do you hang out at any wine bars? I mean, do you
no,
ever
No, I'm
run
not a that's wine not, bar hanger out.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's nothing in Jersey that you hang out in?
Definitely no, not
definitely
in wine
not,
bars
yeah.
in New Jersey.
All right.
So Jersey is BYO land.
No, thank God.
Thank God.
How much money have you and I saved
I
in the
even,
last 25
Well, no, because
years.
We spend it all on our taxes.
I know, that's true, especially where you are.
Oh, yeah.
All right, do you have, it doesn't have to be one like the restaurant thing, could be a few or maybe it's one. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Is there a wine that to this day
yes.
changed you, or was it a birth wine?
It didn't change me, but it was...
Made an impression.
1989 Aubryon, just because...
good vintage year.
Great
vintage,
wine maker. Great wine. It's been now a long time because it was thanks to Park B. Smith, the...
the Cru Veritas guys?
Not Cru, but Veritas.
Veritas, yeah.
And also Park B. Smith, Home Furnishings, you know, brilliant, wonderful, generous man. And that was the first time I ever shared that, and 1995 Rayos, which with Park was just you know, generosity itself.
Was it at the restaurant or at a dinner? Do you remember?
It was at Park's house.
It was,
actually,
okay.
Yeah.
He had a heck of a collection.
Yeah.
So the Rayos and the Aubryon,
yeah.
good ones.
What the heck?
This, I think you're very qualified to answer.
I like the way you preface that.
No, I
maybe
think
I'm
you
not.
Are. And I always set this question up the same way. Best wine around $15 retail, mm-hmm. a red and a white. My kids are in their mid-late 20s. They're starting to make a few bucks. They're not going to go out and buy a $50, $60 bottle of wine for a dinner or a party.
Right.
So, but they want to bring something nice, interesting, What are they buying in the 15 to 20 range?
Oh, you've got
give
a
me
lot
a
of.
White, give me a white. You can give me category.
I'll give you categories. And there's like, a lot you can do in that. In
shoot.
That. You've got from the Loire Valley, you've got Muscadet, you've got some Chenin from the Samur region. You've got basic Chablis. You've got
is that
some
village
nice,
or petite Chablis?
Just regular Chablis.
Regular
just
Chablis.
AOC.
Okay.
You've got some really nice Suaves. You've got
From Italy.
Suave
nice.
From Italy, from Veneto. You've got some white wines from Alto Adige.
Hot region.
You've got and you know you can get basic Etna reds, but I would probably go to the Douro for the red in that range.
Douro, Portugal.
The Douro Valley of Portugal.
Okay. Good value there. I mean, you could find a $15, $18, $20 red.
Most definitely. The problem is finding the wines, you know, because there's not many stores.
Better shot that, around here than most places.
Yeah, no, definitely. In New York is definitely an advantage. Cru Beaujolais, absolutely.
Yep.
In the 15 and 16 vintage. I'm trying to think because I'm thinking about American wines and it's just more difficult. You
it
know,
doesn't
in
come
that,
up a
in
lot.
That, category. I mean, you can.
You're
find,
better off with a Chinon, yeah. You know, versus. Some,
you can maybe find a basic. You know, could find like an Oregon Pinot Gris. That's nice. You know,
that's
in that
cool.
price range.
Washington State.
Washington
Riesling.
State. And Chateau Saint Michel. You know, very solid.
All right, those are all good ones. I'm going to post all those answers. Last question, quick one, because we got to take wine, and I promised I'd get you out of here on time for your dinner or meeting or whatever. Other wine writers that influenced you or you admire?
Well, you know, the man that influenced me, and he's really sick of my saying this every time I see him, is Gerald Asher. When I was a student and I read his book, he was in the wine trade. And actually, I once worked for Gerald Asher when I was one of my unsuccessful
Tell
jobs.
Tell everyone who Gerald is.
Oh, Gerald Asher was the longtime wine columnist for Gourmet. But before he was the Gourmet wine columnist, he was a wine merchant in London.
Right.
And that's the book
he's
that
British,
I read. Yeah, and then he moved to San Francisco, but he is just such a beautiful writer. And he, for a time, he was the president of Mosswood Wine Company, which was where I was a sales trainee. They fired me because I didn't type well, though. But they gave me a going away party and a cake. So
that ain't happening anymore.
That's a bad typist. They said we're
Gerald
really
Asher.
Sorry, Letty.
Okay. All right.
One
so,
of them. But Kermit Lynch.
Kermit
marvelous.
Lynch, his book
Adventures
is terrific.
On the Wine Route.
He just updated it.
Yeah, he wrote for me at Food and Wine. I'll never forget. He was always in France, and he would fax me like edits, and I'd always have to tell the copy editor not to change.
Very
things
interesting guy, still walking the walk. Mm-hmm. I think Anthony's doing a lot of writing for his site now.
Uh-huh.
His son.
Uh-huh.
All right, Letty, we're going to move to our last segment, our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste a 2015 Olivier Le Flav,
mm-hmm.
Bourguignon Le Sety. It's a Chardonnay from the Puligny, Montrachet, and Merzot regions of France.
Mm-hmm.
Two hoity-toity great wine
hoity-toity.
Regions.
Hoity-toity!
This wine retails for about $20, so mm-hmm. it's a pretty good price point from a good maker and a good wine. And it's available at better stores. I told you the reason I picked this is because I know you're
because it wasn't Chablis.
Because I know you're a Chablis lover,
you're a
and
contrarian.
I want to get a Chablis lover captive.
Okay.
And taste a wine
serve
that's
me some
not
warm
Chablis.
White wine, Sam.
And I first quickly tell me difference between Chablis and a white Bourguignon. Don't evaluate the wine yet.
Oh,
let's
sorry,
talk
I took
region.
A sip. Okay.
Oh, no,
well,
that's okay.
Well, Burgundy is divided into five subregions, and of which Chablis is one and the northernmost. So, this is from the Côte d'Or. So it's from a different region, but and from the Côte de Beaune, the southern portion of the Côte d'Or. So, it's going to be stylistically, a rounder, warmer, richer, less angular, wine, less pronounced acidity. I think this wine, as you noted, is pretty widely available, is really well priced. Le Flav, it's a very solid wine, year to year.
So question. It definitely, if you put the two wines side by side of Chablis in this is a rounder, richer
and
wine.
And this has got some oak, I'm guessing.
Well, that was my question. The grape is a Chardonnay grape.
Same grape, but
the farming
different
is right, and the treatment.
So different region, more southerly region,
right, which has some effect on the juice,
right, and
definite
the ripeness
use
of, the
of oak versus.
And I think there's a little bit of I don't know maybe maybe it might be like a year. I don't know that there's that much new oak. It's probably not.
Right.
I don't have a tech sheet.
You know what? It's maybe 20% new oak.
Okay, so it's
I remember looking at the stat.
Okay, then, which I would guess, but in Chablis, that's almost unheard of, except for maybe in a few Grand Crus, there might be a little bit.
Like you said, a Chablis is more
stainless steel
focused,
fermentation.
Precise.
Yeah, yeah, much more angular.
Right, and your preference is.
Well, you know, stylistically, I can appreciate this, and certainly there would be dishes you would want. I mean, I would have this with a crab cake. Sure.
All right, so let's evaluate it now. So
a crab cake.
Let's give it a sniff, and then we'll throw it over the tongue. So color wise, it's sort of it's that pale yellow,
it's a little gold
mm-hmm. color. Now, give me your nose descriptors.
Mm-hmm. That's like a little, like sort of a little lemon.
I get lemon. I get a little pear.
Maybe a little pear. Maybe a little almost sort of a slight creme brulee, you know, from the oak.
Yeah. Yep, I agree with you on that.
Lemon custard kind of thing going on.
All right, now let's go mouthfeel.
It's really nicely balanced, you know, because you get
acidity.
Mm-hmm, definitely get acidity, but it has some, and there's a really nice texture. It has some nice weight in the mouth, you know.
As Peter would say, it's not that fat
not
of
that
a wine.
Fatty,
it's
right.
a full bodied
right,
wine, but it's
right.
not a fatty, right?
It's a trim. It's a trim.
It's a trim. All right, so what trim do we say? Chardonnay. Medium body plus?
I would say medium body.
Medium body.
I don't say plus.
Okay.
I don't know where you got that.
I use that term just from osmosis. People around me say that.
Medium plus.
Medium plus. Medium minus.
Right, channeling Oz.
Yeah. All right, let's take another sip and give me some palate descriptors.
I just did, Sam. You weren't listening.
That was nose. Mm. You did palate?
I said it had it was well balanced, has a very nice texture. It has a bit of richness, you know, up front, and it finishes very clean, you know, very bright. It's not terribly complex, but it's nicely put together, you know, where nothing is overt. It has good acidity, but it, you know, and
any fruit, flour, I mean, any
maybe
of that?
A little pear, a little lemon.
The,
you know?
The not, nose like carries going, through.
I don't
to
like
the,
to go wild on the old okay. fruit basket, you know.
Yeah. Chat, you know. all right. It's not too oaky, not too buttery, right?
No, I'm definitely not buttery.
But not know? Too
Touch
complex either.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
It's $20, Sam.
Yeah.
What are you expecting?
All right, so what foods would you pair with this? Crab cake would go well.
Crab cake.
Give me
chicken,
one.
Roast chicken.
Roast chicken.
Any kind of fish in a cream sauce.
Okay.
Or even just any kind of, you know, shrimp, pasta.
So a lot of times you pair to the sauce, not the meat. So this would hold
definitely.
Up to a cream sauce.
I think so, yeah.
On a chicken. I agree with
richness.
You on that.
And it also has some nice, you know, cleansing acidity.
Do we like, love, okay? What do we think of this wine?
We like it.
It's
good
for the month.
Yeah. It's
for this style.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would not be displeased if you brought this to my house.
Right. If you were roasting chickens and
even if I wasn't.
Okay.
You could still come.
All right. All right. So that's the 2015 Olivier Laflave Bourguignon Lissette available on the market now. Letty and I like it. Definitely a certain style. If you want a more angular, you know, precise wine with minerality, the Chablis. In steel tanks would probably be better, but if you want a more full
you know,
body,
don't be you know underselling Olivier Laflave.
No. Stylistically,
nice, yeah.
If you want a fuller bodied wine, I mean this is your wine.
I thought you're backing away from your wine.
No,
okay.
no, and it's done well for the price. All right, I'll post the wine on our site, Letty. We're going to wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. I'll post Letty's wine list answers. I'll post what we're drinking. I'll post a bunch of the suggestions Letty made during the show. I'll post our weekly wine sip selection, like I said. Follow The Grape Nation on Instagram at SBenRuby. And now you can follow hashtags. Follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. And on Twitter, we're at BenRuby and hashtag The Grape Nation. Letty, if we want to find you on social media, we have to search a little. But Twitter?
At Letty Teague1.
At Letty Teague1. LettyTeague1. The number one. And if people want to dig around for columns, they can go to
Wall Street. Subscribe to the Wall Street Journal.
Well, no, ironically, if you go to the Wall Street Journal and dig up your column, you get the first paragraph, and then you have to subscribe.
Oh, well, then.
So you have to do that anyway. But you can go to wallstreetjournal.com. All right. I want to thank our guest, Letty Teague. Letty is the is an author and wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Look for her columns. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.